Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast about nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Kay, and I use pronouns like she and her.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and my pronouns are they, them, theirs.
And I'm Katie, and my pronouns are they, them.
In this episode, we'll discuss the 18th Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Proper 23 or Lectionary 28, which this year falls on October 9th.
Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
This week, with all of these healing stories, we are doing a deep dive into nursing with our special guest, Katie Hall, who is an ICU nurse who has been at the bedside through the entire COVID pandemic. Before they started a career in nursing, Katie completed their master's in theology and particularly enjoys historical theology and generally being a nerd. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're so glad you're here.
We are really glad you're here. So, starting off, of course, what are your favorite and least favorite parts of nursing?
So, my favorite parts, I'd have to say, are seeing patients get better, which, being in the ICU, is not always a given.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I joke that, you know, with Henry VIII, you have divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. In the ICU, we have dead, downgraded, went to rehab. That's it.
Mm.
Most of them... die or go to some kind of long-term rehab where we don't ever know if they get better or not. And every once in a while, we'll have a patient who comes back and it's like, oh my Lord, like last time I saw you, you were in a coma for 2 months and now you're walking again.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. Least favorite parts. I hate the capitalism in US healthcare, which I saw. I'm probably going to talk a little bit more about later, but it's
us, just, capitalism.
The whole system's a mess.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So a couple of our readings today include references to leprosy, also known these days as Hansen's disease, which is, as I understand it, both rare and fairly treatable now, at least certainly compared to the ancient world. But in biblical times, it made someone an untouchable outcast for the rest of their lives with no coming back from it, as my understanding. And so I was wondering, have you seen medical conditions do that kind of thing to people's lives, to their social standing in your career in modern day?
I mean, I'm a bit young for the, you know, when I talk with older nurses who were working during the AIDS pandemic, that was definitely a huge thing of, you know, no one wanted those patients. No one wanted to touch them. No one wanted to be near them. Today, I'd like to think we don't have anything like that as much. As far as medical conditions that are socially stigmatized, there's so much with just like fat phobia and ableism of just like, well, if you're sick or if you're chronically ill, obviously it's your own fault. And if you just make better choices, you would be fine. So it's a lot of victim blaming that kind of feeds into the social stigma, but not so much like the completely untouchable side of things.
Yeah, I was wondering when I saw Kay was asking that question, I was like, HIV AIDS pandemic is like,
yeah, I was quite sure that was going to come up, but yes. I'm glad to hear you say that it's not, there's not something just like that now, at least.
I was wondering though about monkeypox, but I imagine monkeypox does not put you in the ICU, so.
Yeah, I actually have not, I have not seen a monkeypox case yet. I know, I mean, I guess I know my hospital has had some just because they've talked about it on like our social media thing or whatever, but I have not personally run into monkeypox yet. It's always a yet.
Right. Yeah. There, eventually there will be. Yeah. So I'm curious what you wish non-healthcare workers knew about nursing and healthcare workers these days. I know I was a chaplain for the beginning of the pandemic and the first like half so far of a pandemic that, contrary to the president's opinion, has not ended.
Yeah.
So I know some of healthcare in the pandemic, but I'm curious what you wish folks knew.
I mean, as far as what I wish folks knew about nursing, I feel like a lot of folks don't know what nurses actually do. They just kind of have this idea of like, oh, we're the doctor's assistants that walk around and hand out medications. And I think unless you're routinely in the hospital, you don't realize how much nurses are actually doing. Like, there's a joke that the RN stands for refreshments and narcotics because that's all we're good for. That is not the case. We do more than refreshments and narcotics.
Yeah.
Also, like, nurses are on that list of people along with, like, wait staff at restaurants and other groups of people who you just don't want to piss off. So why would you say that? But I,
Yes. I mean, one of the things that I love particularly being in the ICU, where my patients are critically ill, like their condition can change at any time. The doctors make rounds in the morning. They're not in the room every 30 minutes. I'm in the room every 30 minutes. And so my job is to be constantly watching and assessing, because if the doctor's going to come and be like, oh, I heard this changed, the reason they heard that change is because the nurse set up some red flags and said, hey, this is going on. We need to come assess this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that a lot of times folks view nursing as subordinate to medicine, but there's a whole lot. It's more of an interdisciplinary team. Like the physicians I work with are my colleagues, not my boss.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But as far as nursing and healthcare workers these days, Lord, we are all burned out. All of us.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, it's been hard having families start to come back to being at the bedside because we all got used to making the, I know there's a term for it, like the graveyard humor, or like you're in the trenches.
Gallows humor.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We all got used to the gallows humor just all the time. And then all of a sudden we have families back at the bedside.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Or we have patients who are conscious and can hear us, and we're like, okay, gotta keep a straight face, gotta watch what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because we all, you know, we all want our patients to do better and to get better, but we also know that a lot of the times they're not going to, and we have to carry that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds a lot like the difference between going from a clergy gathering to going to someone's bedside as a clergy person and having to change the way you talk. Yeah.
I know as a chaplain, I really appreciated the work that nurses did, both in that we could have gallows humor, right? Like that laughter is an integral part of health and healing and wellness, not just for like patients, but for also those who are constantly facing, like you said, really, really sick, deathly ill people who are actively dying. And so to be able to have the lighthearted moments is really helpful. But also one of the things, and I don't know that this is the case in all hospitals, but certainly in ours, sometimes doctors would be the ones to talk to patients' families, especially if they were like coming in the ER, in the trauma bay.
Yeah.
But when once they got to the ICU,
it's all on nursing.
The nurses were the ones to talk to, right? Like I had relationships with the nurses in the ICU. There were a couple doctors, but for the most part, it was the nurses who had to come in and tell families and loved ones that they needed to make a really hard decision or that their loved one was not going to make it, or those sorts of things. And that's, I don't know that you all are properly equipped and trained for that.
Like, we are just thrown into the fire and figure it out as you go.
That was my impression. Yeah. So like there were a lot of nurses who like were just terrified to do it, but also like did it so well, right? There's clearly care for the patient when nurses are talking to loved ones, which I appreciate.
One time I had a patient that was just like critically ill and about to die. And the doctors kept saying, and the family was like, oh, well, we want to do everything. We're going to do everything. And yes, we're doing everything. But I stopped and I said, you guys need to call any family who needs to come in, and they need to come now. Because the doctors weren't saying that, because the family was still, we're full steam ahead. So the doctors were like, yes, we're full steam ahead. And one of the family members got there and they were kind of pissed of like, oh, the doctors are giving up. And I was like, no. I don't want you to lose this moment.
Yeah.
We're doing everything we can. I want to make sure that you have this time. And he died that night, but he had about 20 people that came in to visit him and to sit with him and pray with him before he died.
Sure.
Yeah. Which is huge. Like the,
Yeah.
We had some times where it was like the doctor who was in charge, like the doctor who was in charge of the doctory things was like refusing to have those hard conversations with family, even of just like, we need to consider other things.
Yeah.
Because heaven forbid they admit that they might not be able to save someone.
Yes.
Yeah.
oncologists are terrible about it. I don't know what it is. They're like, oh, you have cancer, but we can get you through it. And I'm like, hang on. Have you really talked with the family about what's going on here?
Right.
Yeah. Actually, come to think of it, that was the least realistic part of House MD as a TV show, because Wilson was so good at that, and I had never seen a doctor manage those conversations like that.
Yeah. We had some trauma docs who were really good, and some trauma docs who were like, we will save this person, whatever the cost. And it was just like,
no.
There's a little room for, like, conversation about quality of life that matters here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
You know, healthcare.
Exactly.
I hadn't thought of it until you put it that way, but when you were talking about the doctors who, you know, come in for a moment and vanish, and then the nurses who are there all the time, I kind of think now that the doctors are like the image of God that a lot of people have of, you know, distant and far away and removed. And the nurses are the Holy Spirit, just, you know, there and smacking you over the head with stuff all the time.
I like and... it. Yeah, I'm going to picture the Holy Spirit now coming in and doing a sternal rub on someone.
Yeah. Well, and when I spent a short time as a chaplain, I wasn't one like Emily was for a long time, but I did do a couple of months at it. One of the things they talked to us about was the very strange place of being a hospital patient and how that changes how you think of yourself and how other people see you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we brushed on this a little bit earlier, but our country generally does run healthcare as a for-profit business, and I was wondering, what are some ways that this impacts your day-to-day work as a nurse?
So there's one patient that I remember when I can't remember if I was a student or a brand new baby nurse, but, you know, we have a lot of folks come into the medical ICU with COPD exacerbation. Like, that's a very common thing that we see.
Yeah.
But so this mm-hmm. woman was homeless and was supposed to be on oxygen, and she had a portable oxygen concentrator, but businesses don't really like homeless people sitting around at their business. And she could not find anywhere that would have let her sit down to plug in and charge her oxygen concentrator. And so she ran out of oxygen and then is in the ICU for days, you know, trying to recover from this. And it's such a, you know, if you have a quality social safety net, you know, if you have the universal healthcare, but then also the social services and, mm-hmm. you know, the social safety net to help people not hit rock bottom, then you can avoid, you know, the cost to her health, the cost to her, you know, life, the risks for infection. And, you know, if you want to be a capitalist about it, you can avoid the expense to the hospital and to the taxpayer. Which is not how I like to think about healthcare, but
right,
there are. I feel you on
the like, yeah. The money is not the reason to do anything, and also, it is actually cheaper to just give every single person a house than it is to take care of people when they are homeless and then get sick or injured or whatever.
Yeah,
it's amazing how
The system we have set up is not set up because it saves the government money. It's set up that way to punish poor people, punish people for not being what the dominant class thinks that they should be.
Yeah.
Which we'll get into this more later, but like that goes into the like healthcare and healthiness for as morality or good and like all that stuff. But the system being set up to punish poor people. There are some times when I like, for it's not that I forget that, but like that particular phrasing of it is just like, yeah, that's capitalism for you.
Yep. Very on point.
Yeah. Speaking of things that are not great, healthcare and other essential workers are great. They're the great ones.
Yes.
But have been called heroes basically since the pandemic started. And this country has this unique habit of treating heroes like those who are able to be sacrificed for the quote-unquote greater good. So, like, that's what we do with anyone who serves in the military, for sure.
Yeah.
But also, like, in pop culture, Tony Stark's death in the Avengers movies is sacrificing the hero for the greater good. Natasha Romanoff. Triss in the Divergent series, Nancy in Nightmare on Elm Street, the third movie, which were, you know, shout out to Horror Nerds at Church, because that's what we're doing this season. But in our first reading for this episode, the hero and the solution are like so unexpectedly small, right? It's a prisoner of war and a small river. So I'm curious how you think these heroes could help reframe how we think about heroes kind of more broadly.
Well, I think we, you know, when we talk about heroes, it's like we're talking about something or someone that's going to come and save us from a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a better way, you know, particularly, you know, in a religious frame of when you look at heroes, it should be someone who you can model your behavior after, or someone who you can look up to and strive to be like.
Sure.
Because that way, heroism is something that the community is continually working toward, whereas if you're looking at a hero as this one individual who's coming in to save you, then the community has no responsibility because we can all go out without our masks and we can all say F you to vaccines and the healthcare heroes will come and save us.
Yeah.
But heroism needs to be more of a community thing, and an individual hero can be someone who exemplifies that in a particular way, but it can't be that they're the sole person carrying the load.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I hadn't made the connection to, right, like the whitewashing of Martin Luther King Jr. since his assassination, that he has now become the hero, not to model your life after, but the one who comes in and saves. Yes. And therefore, no one else could possibly live up to that.
Right.
Therefore, no. We just have to wait till we
and
all
that Martin
are...
Luther King, like, so much of his work was community building and community organizing. And then to kind of erase all of that and just put him as, here's the one hero who's coming in to save us, and now he's gone and we can remember him and the work he did, completely derails and stops the progress of the community, which is what he had been working to build.
Yeah.
Especially since the Poor People's Campaign that he started was recently restarted and is so desperately needed
in this
country.
Is it Dr. William Barber, the Reverend Dr. William Barber? Yes, love him.
Yeah. And like the throwing in there, right, the other names and the other people that got erased from like misogynoir, right? Like Rosa Parks, not an old lady who was tired.
Yeah.
Right.
She did that on purpose and it was strategic.
Exactly.
But like Bayard Rustin, all of them just,
yeah.
And some of them got erased and some of them just got downplayed.
Yeah. And for that matter, we can also recognize that Martin Luther King Jr. may not have been a perfect human being and might have had flaws.
Definitely.
And yet still managed to do these extraordinary things.
Yes.
And that means that maybe some of the rest of us who also have flaws could also do some extraordinary things.
And particularly, you know, if we come back to kind of a biblical model of heroism, all the biblical heroes are flawed. I mean,
so much.
Everybody.
Oh my gosh, so the number of people that think David is perfect. And I'm just
oh my lord. David was a rapist
and committed war crimes. Like,
oh lord, yes.
Yeah.
Yep. No. And then you got Moses, who was a murderer, and you know, Gideon was a straight up coward hiding in the wine press. And then it's like, oh, you're going to lead the army. Okay, sure. Yeah.
And so, again, something we've already brushed up against, certainly before the pandemic, but massively increased since it started, our culture, especially in America, not just in America, I guess, but like I think definitely impacted by the way capitalism plays into our healthcare system, we tend to see health as a moral quality. Being a particular type of healthy means that you're good. Being unhealthy means that it must be your fault. And I'm not trying to downplay how fat phobia plays into this and is totally a part of this, but it's not just fat phobia. It's also other kinds of conditions. It's asthma, it's diabetes, it's any number of conditions that have come to the forefront and become more obvious since the pandemic started because of how they don't play well with COVID. And I mean, no one plays well with COVID, but that's kind of the point. But there are all of these conditions that have become more well-known and more visible because of who masks and who doesn't and so on, and who can have vaccines and who actually can't get vaccinated. And I was wondering how this attitude toward health being a moral quality? How does that play into your daily life as a nurse?
It makes it really hard, especially because a lot of times that kind of judgment is coming from other folks in healthcare. You know, so a patient will come in and there's this kind of, oh, well, you did this to yourself kind of attitude that is not helpful to anyone. It doesn't help the person who's sick. It doesn't help them get any better. You know, it's just, I think part of it comes to kind of like a prosperity gospel kind of thing of, ooh, I'm going to reassure myself that if I do everything right, everything will be good for me. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It won't happen to me.
Yeah.
But so there's the blaming of, you know, people who drew the short straw on health, because that way at least you can feel better that it's not going to happen to you. And that's just not the way health works.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about that a lot, particularly for disabilities, right? Where basically if you live long enough, you will become disabled. Like that's how our bodies work. And so then like the people who... the able-bodied people who are like, well, it's your own fault. They, like, you just need to try harder and you'll be okay. You'll be able to walk. Or why do you need that? Mm-hmm. You should be able to.
And yet, oddly enough, those same people tend to be the ones that don't want to see the elderly in public anyway. So
yeah.
When they get elderly, I'm sure their opinion on that will be different.
Right.
I mean, we, not so long ago, we used to have ugly laws that made it illegal to be disabled in public.
Yeah, and speaking of things we don't teach in American public high school history classes.
Yeah. I'm always upset whenever I see... So there's a pattern in American journalism to make photos black and white to make it look like it was longer ago than it was. Mm-hmm.
With MLK, so like, they do it all the time.
Yes, with MLK. Like, all those photos were taken in color.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that was in the 90s. Like, when people...
Yeah.
left their wheelchairs at the steps of the Capitol and crawled up the stairs. That was in full color. But no. We're going to go back and we're going to make all those pictures black and white to make it seem like this was a different age and we're separate from that.
Right. Yeah. Whereas I was actually not just alive, but walking around and in school by that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's this, like, I was also alive and in school around then, at least somewhere around then. Yeah. I keep getting tripped up. Like, I was reading a thing the other day about the BMI, the body mass index.
Yes.
There's someone on Twitter who is really great to follow. It's Fat Doctor, I think, is like what I've seen.
Yes. I think I know just who you're talking about.
I've seen them, but they had like this whole thing about the history of the BMI that like was created by a eugenicist, right? Like by somebody whose like work is trying to figure out how to like not let certain people reproduce and like kill people. Like, and that's how we got the BMI. And yet like the number of times it shows up on every chart that I ever charted on. It showed up and you could tell where people fell on it. And I also worked on the like pregnancy labor delivery floor. And so like that was especially like ridiculous. Cause I was like, well, of course they are. Like they are literally pregnant.
They're carrying an extra person or two.
Yeah.
I am actually currently in the process of changing from one insurance company to another. And the company I'm changing to is technically better health insurance, and I'm looking forward to being on that again. But the one thing that they do is they constantly pelt you with your BMI information, and the previous insurance company frankly didn't care enough about me to do that. Like they weren't paying that close attention. And I am going to miss not hearing my BMI every 3 months like clockwork.
I'm switching onto the same healthcare that Kay is switching onto. It's just taking me months and months to get onto it because they are being terrible about it.
Paperwork, yay.
Yeah, it's almost like even nonprofit healthcare companies are capitalist.
Yeah.
And affected by all that.
Yeah.
Well, and because the hospital that I work at is a nonprofit, is a government, but all the hospitals around us have been slowly been bought up by some of these bigger, over time, really, there's just a couple major corporations that are buying up all the hospitals. Yeah. And then they have the negotiating power to set the terms. And so then you know, it's worse for the rural hospitals. It's worse for the nonprofit and the government, the state hospitals, because they can't compete on scale.
Yeah. When I was in Iowa, we had gotten down to like the Catholic hospital and the other hospital, which was a combination of formerly religious, like had historic ties to denominations, but was like a regional thing. And it's it was a nonprofit. Like both were nonprofits because they're affiliated the way they are, but it was just like, this is slowly the rural hospitals, and the like Medicare expansion was particularly good for for rural hospitals, and then the states that didn't do it were just like, screw you, we don't care.
Exactly.
But anyway, ugh, hospitals, capitalism, healthcare,
it's just the worst.
Indeed. So there's, like we mentioned, a lot of healing in today's readings, and particularly in Luke, there is this sense with healing and other aspects of Jesus' ministry that it's about the like here and now. It's about community. It's about restoration and wholeness. And so I'm curious, particularly because you're an ICU nurse, and so you see some of the worst cases, and frequently it's not that people get like cured of their illness or injury. So I'm curious how you've maybe witnessed or experienced healing or community in the midst of all that ICU nursing is.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes healing is the patient gets better. Sometimes healing is the patient dies in peace. Sometimes healing is the family and the patient get the time that they need to be together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, particularly as like a chaplain-y role, which obviously you have a particular perspective, but like,
Oh, our chaplain service has been trying to recruit me to come work with NPRN. I love our chaplains.
I bet you would be great at it, but that's true of like most of the nurses who had particular skills in nursing also, I was like, oh, you could also do the chaplaincy thing.
Yeah.
You could do it.
As long as you can care about people. I think I also remember a situation where the healing was that the family was finally under enough pressure that they were honest with each other for the first time in literal years. And like, it wasn't necessarily a good or happy conversation, but it was one they had to have.
Yeah.
Healing can look like a lot of things.
Yeah, that makes sense. My aunt died last year, and she had just maybe like a month-ish on home hospice. And I was able to fly out and visit her briefly right when she was going on to hospice. And so like she was meeting with the hospice nurse and all of that stuff. And so I got like tasked by my mom to like do the checklists and do the things, because it's so hard for some family to have those conversations, right?
Yes.
What do you want as you are dying is not a conversation that like most people are prepared to have, but it's such an important conversation. And there was stuff that was really beautiful that my aunt and I got to talk about that nobody else talked about with her. And the same when my grandmother was in hospice. I have another question I'm going to add in. It's a surprise bonus question.
Lightning round.
Yeah. If you could give people, like, what advice would you give people to make their experiences in healthcare, especially maybe if they end up in, like, an ICU type situation, but also could be more broadly just in healthcare in general, what advice would you give them that they could do now to be better, like, set up for that?
I mean, the biggest thing is talking with your family about what you want, what you don't want. And part of that takes, you know, knowing what the options are. And when a lot of people don't have any ideas, they think it's either, oh, I give up and die, or we do everything all the way up until the end. And so, you know, talking with like, okay, are you okay, you know, getting a tracheostomy? Are you okay living on a home ventilator? Are you okay being in a wheelchair for the rest of your life? Are you okay getting tube feeds? You know, what is quality of life for you, and what medical assistance are you willing to accept, you know? And so I've told my partner very clearly, my minimums are, I want to be able to communicate and I want to be able to enjoy spending time with the people I love. If I can't have both of those things, I don't care about the rest of it. Just let me go, you know? Yeah. And so, and I'm kind of an outlier in the ICU, you know, when we talk about this at the nurse's station, where I'm perfectly okay with, you know, a home ventilator or a wheelchair or a peg tube, you know, because I'd like to think that disability is not something that scares me. It would be a loss of self. Mm-hmm. And if I can't communicate and I can't enjoy being around the people that I love, I'm losing myself.
Yeah. That's a really, I really like that way of thinking about it.
It's a very healthy way of thinking about it.
Yeah. I've been thinking about it a lot more in the last several years of pandemic and family members and things. But one of the things that I think people don't understand is intubation. Like, there were people that would come in as patients who were DNI, but not DNR. So mm-hmm. do not resuscitate is like no CPR, no like the clear shocks. Yeah. But DNI is do not intubate. And like the actual like stress and strain that your body goes through when it can't breathe on its own, but it's still like trying to be resuscitated or like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I will just say, please don't put DNI if you're not putting DNR.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is my like, there's not a lot that I will like categorically tell you, but that is one of the things because.
Yeah. I mean, intubation is usually before resuscitation. You're saying stop at an earlier step with yes. DNI.
Or, you know, if someone does have a cardiac arrest and we're coding them, you intubate as part of the code mm-hmm. to secure the airway sure. because at that moment the person is dead and they can't protect their own airway.
Yeah. Right.
So you're saying, okay, you can do the compressions and you can break all my ribs to try to get me back, but then you're not allowed to breathe for me.
Right. Where yeah. it's like, if you're doing that much work, let them do yeah. all of the work possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I've run into a number of people who don't realize that they can set any kind, like, I mean, in this paperwork of your advanced directive or whatever you want to call it, you can set literally any limit you want, including something like, okay, go out all out nonstop, do everything for 3 days. But if after 3 days yep. I can't handle it on my own, then call it.
Yeah.
And, you know, or a time mm-hmm. limit or any number of other different kinds of limits. And all of those are available to you.
I had a patient who sat with the hospital chaplain making an advance directive and said, you can intubate me no more than 2 weeks.
Sure.
At 2 weeks, pull it. And yeah. the family, as we started getting closer and closer to that 2 week mark, the family was so stressed and so anxious. And we had to tell them, your loved one took this responsibility off of your shoulders. This is not a choice that you are making. This is not anything that you have to do. This is something that they decided for themselves. And so that, like, first of all, you know, if you make an advance directive and you talk with your family about what you want,
mm-hmm.
you're making sure that you get what you want in your final days, but you're also really alleviating the burden on your family of having to make the decisions for you.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. They get to just be family.
Yes.
At that point.
Yes.
Which is a huge gift.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to throw out there, Katie, before we jump into the readings?
Nope. Let's go read about leprosy.
Yay!
Yay! Wait, that didn't sound right. So our first reading for this episode is from 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 through 3 and 7 through 15c, which basically means most of verse 15. General Naaman of Syria is sent by an Israelite prisoner of war to the prophet Elisha to be healed of his leprosy. He is cured of both his leprosy and his pride and proclaims the God of Israel as the only God.
So one of the themes in this is the idea of unexpected help, right? So there's the prisoner of war who helps him. There's Elisha who helps instead of the king. There's the Jordan instead of the rivers of Damascus. And my favorite example of unexpected help is in the Hunger Games when Rue helps Katniss. And
little tiny sweet Rue.
Right? The teeny tiny adorableness. And then Katniss is like the survivor. And yet Rue provides like really important help. Which I love.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. In verse 13, we read, but Naaman's servants approached and said to him, Father, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it? How much more, when all he said to you was, wash and be clean? So Naaman had objected to the idea of, how dare he just tell me to go wash in the Jordan River? There should be fancy rituals and I should get more personal attention and I'm more important than all this. But instead, Elisha just told him, go wash off in the Jordan River. God will take care of it. You'll be fine. And he was not entirely thrilled with that. And this very much reminds me of the first Jason Bourne movie, when at one point he and his girlfriend Marie need a room number, I think, for a guy who's staying at a hotel or something like that. Maybe that it was a bank. I don't remember exactly what they were looking for, but they needed a piece of information. And so Jason scopes out the building, comes up with this whole very detailed, complicated plan, runs through the plan about 47 times with Marie, who is clearly bored out of her skull by this point. And they go into the building. They're ready to take the plan through. And instead of going with the plan, Marie notices that one of the clerks at the front desk looks incredibly bored and lonely, and she goes up and she smiles at him and they have a little chat and she gets the information without any, you know, of the plan happening whatsoever, and she goes back out and Jason is just floored. And I don't know if anyone else is a fan of Matt Damon's face when he is just completely what? But I am particularly fond of that expression because I love something about leading men who can do the, I have no idea what's going on right now face. That just is delightful to me.
Yes, it's adorable.
Yes, it very much reminded me of Naaman, because sometimes you don't need the big fancy stuff. Sometimes, in fact, what's going on is not actually about the big fancy stuff that you want to come up with, Jason or Naaman. Sometimes it's just about getting the piece of information or getting rid of the leprosy.
Yeah.
Yes. You don't always need a Rube Goldberg machine to make healing happen.
If you're going to do a Rube Goldberg machine, do it purely for the quality of entertainment, not to do something that's actually necessary.
Truth. They are fun and I love them. But yeah.
I've enjoyed building some with my 5-year-old.
Ooh, aww. That would be super fun.
Yeah. Oh, as I would have loved that as a 5-year-old. I wound up doing it as a high school physics class project, and it was still fun, but...
But as a 5-year-old, especially
fun. That would have been fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in verse 14, we read, "So Naaman went down and immersed himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. His flesh was restored like the flesh of a young boy, and he was clean." This is not the same kind of healing as happens in The Expanse, with the proto molecule, where it like heals and then takes over everything, and probably not like the creepy creatures in the last season in the Ring Planets that like bring the dead boy back to life. But maybe it's more like those creatures, like the river is its own creature of healing.
Yeah.
I don't know. But definitely not the proto molecule. Danger healing.
You know, I hadn't thought of this before, but the image of Naaman immersing himself 7 times in the Jordan, I don't know exactly what that would have looked like, but my initial instinct is to say that probably he was basically doing squats, right? And, like, imagine this general who is so important, and he goes down into the river and has probably taken off most of his, like, you know, important clothing, and just starts doing squats and like, holding his breath, you know, big fat cheeks filled with air, of course, into the river to immerse himself, and then comes back up and does it again 7 times. Like, that, all of his servants must have been holding in their laughter on the shore, right? I have to imagine.
It's a good visual.
It's a fantastic visual and gave me an idea for a later segment in this episode.
I'm good.
I'm very excited. Do you have any other connections that you were making, Katie?
I don't know. The healing narratives in the Bible are always complicated for me, especially coming from a nursing perspective.
Yeah.
Because, you know, on the one hand, we can talk about miraculous healing as, oh, you know, we're looking at this story and this is a sign of, you know, God's love. But then it translates into, well, why doesn't God heal my family member? Why did this patient die? And all the time, we have families coming in and saying, well, God is going to heal this person. They're going to get up and walk out of here. They're going to go home in perfect health. And it's hard because on the one hand, I don't want to diminish, you know, faith is important, but it's hard because you can't, miracles don't happen every day.
Right.
And going back to the idea that health is something, is a moral thing, something that you do, that ties in with our expectation of miracles, of, okay, if you only have good enough faith, you'll be healed. One of my friends was a neonatal nurse, and she told me a story of a patient where the mom had died in childbirth, and the neonate was essentially brain dead in the NICU, and you know, she was standing with the father and comforting him, and the father's pastor came in and said, if you pray hard enough, if you believe enough, this baby will wake up and come home with you.
Nope.
And that just shattered that person's entire faith, because that baby was not going to survive.
Yeah.
And I just think it's hard when we start talking about the miracles in the Bible, because not everybody gets a miracle. Most people don't get miracles.
Yep. Yeah.
The trouble with miracles is that they are, by definition, unpredictable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the Catholic chaplains that worked at the hospital with me and I would talk about the sacrament of the sick, which most people still refer to as
last rites.
Last rites, right. But the Catholic Church officially calls it the sacrament of the sick.
Yeah.
And he would talk about doing the sacrament of the sick, and he always wanted as many people as possible to be present for it, because the sacraments are acts that should be done within community.
Yeah.
And he would talk about that sometimes, there was miraculous healing of the illness or something a couple times, but the majority of the time, the healing or the presence of God would come in the people gathered together for this sacrament.
Yeah.
Not in a physical or psychological healing that happened because of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we wanted you on.
Yeah, exactly. I don't remember exactly which Bible passage it was, but sometime in the last couple of months, we got a bit where Jesus talked about God's response to prayer and basically said that God's response to prayer is not yes or no, but is the Holy Spirit. And I've been hanging on to that like a lifeline ever since. Mm. But of course, now I can't remember the Bible verse reference. So.
Yeah, I don't know which one you're talking about, but I like it.
Yeah.
I think it's a good response.
And it explains a lot of that whole, the miracles are not necessarily the ones you expect. The miracles are not necessarily the ones you notice, but God is still there. Yeah.
Yeah. Our second reading for this episode is 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 through 15. The author writes Timothy from prison, reminding him that the word of God is always free, and that the gospel message and God's love remain true despite hard circumstances. So this, one of the themes for this passage is the idea of macro instead of micro, right? There's a point where Timothy's like, don't mince words, right? But it's like, it's about looking at the bigger picture. And I was reminded of the show Dear White People, which I watched a while back. But they get into this, right? Because there are certain things that on a micro level are really complicated, but on a macro level just continue to expose the racism that is happening in the college and in the school, even though there's a part that's on a micro level. It's easier for us to explain things away if we just focus in on the micro, but when we take the bigger picture, we can't. And so you can lose the heart of the gospel if you're just trying to get every single word and letter right.
Yeah. Can't see the forest for the trees.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly.
That. Precisely. And then in verse 9 we read, for which I suffer hardship, even to the point of being chained like a criminal. But the word of God is not chained. And I read The Hiding Place, I don't know how many years ago, but it's by Corrie Ten Boom. And it's written by her about her experience and her life. During World War II, she was a clockmaker for the resistance and saved particularly Jewish people and also disabled people from Nazis. And ultimately she got caught and then released because of a clerical error. And I just think about her in the space of being captured for doing what is gospel work. And then she tried to go back and just keep doing that same rescuing work. And it ended up that she had too much, probably, I would guess, PTSD, but too much trauma to be able to do the exact same thing. But still, they kept welcoming in disabled people to hide from the Nazis and Jewish people to hide from the Nazis. And I love her as as an example, especially because contrary to some of the other people we hold up, she did not, to my knowledge, harbor like anti-Semitic undertones. She just was trying to do her best. And I love it.
Yeah. And then in verse 13, we read, "If we are faithless, Jesus remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself." I mean, okay, so Jesus has a lot of special properties because Jesus is God. We've talked about that. We've talked about how there are some things that God gets to say that ordinary people don't get to say because only God gets to say them. And it sounds either, you know, creepy or just psychopathic if a person says them. But also, like, Jesus not being able to deny himself. Like, I have to imagine that even Jesus had bad self-confidence days. I mean, I think we see a couple in the Gospels, although not a ton of them. But you know, not believing in yourself is one thing. But being able to deny your own identity, although goodness knows we've all seen fictional characters try to do that often enough, apparently was not in Jesus' wheelhouse, I guess, according to this. And that immediately made me think of, you know, so there's not believing in yourself like the way that Angela Lansbury sings about in the movie Bedknobs and Broomsticks and the Age of Not Believing, which is a lovely song.
I'm not super familiar with that. Can you sing us a line?
The only line I actually remember how it goes is, "You're in the age of not believing." And I only remember the phrase, but
that's okay, because I'm usually the one that breaks into song on this podcast, and so I just wanted it to be you for a change.
Yes, I noticed. It's also a very fun movie that involves her making various suits of armor start, you know, dancing and fighting on her behalf. And it's for being from when it is, the special effects are not completely terrible. So that was fun. But yeah, there's, you know, not believing in yourself the way that 13-year-olds don't believe in themselves, which is what she was talking about in the song. And then there's also denying your identity as one person of the Trinity, I guess. That must be a whole different thing. So I wouldn't know. I'm not Jesus. I like to say that now and then just to remind people. That must have been exhausting.
Yeah.
Like, I like to imagine that humanity was a learning, what I learned to call in seminary a good learning experience, which are things that I now try to avoid because they are not fun. And yeah, I have to imagine that was one.
Yeah. I mean, we know he got, like, his parents lost him at one point, right? Yeah. At the beginning of puberty. So.
Yeah. Even Mary and Joseph lost Jesus once. So if you do, that's okay. Don't feel bad.
I mean, try and find the kid again, but like.
Well, yeah, sure. Absolutely. They did too.
I thankfully got lost with my dad at Disneyland, not without my dad.
Yes. Our gospel reading for today is from Luke chapter 17, verses 11 through 19. Jesus heals 10 lepers, one of whom, a Samaritan, returns to thank him for it.
So one of the themes in this passage is the idea of going back. We don't, like, a lot of times we just kind of say, no, don't go back. Like, we don't want people to necessarily go back. But this time, the one leper who does go back, who happens to be a Samaritan, is the one that Jesus praises. And I am still thinking about Nancy in Nightmare on Elm Street. Pace and I just recorded that episode this week, so that's why. And yes, I know that HNAC is getting to me. It's weird. I'm not a horror person, but
you weren't,
I might be
person.
Turning into one. Yeah.
That is a whole separate horror movie.
Right. Nancy, who's the main protagonist in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, is not in the second one, but then comes back in the third, and she has gone to school in order to come back and help other kids who are having these nightmares and who are having to deal with Freddy. And I love that idea of coming back and that way of framing coming back, that sometimes when you're coming back for good things and to help others and to do more good in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And speaking of going back is not always a bad thing. In verse 14, we read, "When Jesus saw the lepers, he said to them, 'Go and show yourselves to the priests.' And as they went, they were made clean." And then it's after this that the lepers are clean and no longer have leprosy, and then one of them comes back to thank Jesus and the others don't, and Jesus and the disciples have this whole big thing about how ungrateful and horrid the other nine must be. And my endless problem with the story is that the others are actually following direction. Okay,
they're doing what they were told. They're doing exactly what Jesus said to do.
Jesus said, go show yourself to the priest. Jesus did not say, start going to show yourself to the priest, and then once you're healed, turn back, and then after you come back and you thank me, then you can actually go do what I told you to do in the first place if you want. He just said, go show yourselves to the priest. So they did that, and like, it might be the fact that mm-hmm. I spend a fair amount of my life trying to give people some basic direction without actually telling them what to do, because I know Minnesota Lutherans well enough to never, ever, ever do that. But
yeah,
the idea of someone actually going to the trouble of doing what you told them to do and then scolding them for it just drives me up a wall every time. And I am going to have to figure out how to preach this at some point without... It's my second week at a new call, and I... it'll be my second week at a new call, and I'm going to be irritated with Jesus, and that is not necessarily how you like. You need a little bit more relationship with people before you can go there, usually. So that's going to be
Jesus now in passive aggressive version.
Yes, exactly. And I
mean, there's enough Jesus is up on the walls out there that.
Yeah. No, absolutely, we've got one. I know intellectually that Jesus was from the Middle East, from Palestine, and was brown, but I swear he sounds so much like a Midwestern Lutheran sometimes that I just get so frustrated. But this made me think of the story of Orpheus in Hades, which is actually old enough that these lepers might have known that story and might have been thinking about it, because the instruction that Orpheus got was don't look back. You'll get out. You'll be fine as long as you don't look back. Mm. You have to trust that she's following you and it'll be okay. And these other nine don't look back because they weren't told to. They were told to go show yourself to the priest. And they do that, presumably.
I mean, between that and Lot's wife.
Yeah. And so, like, is it possible that they were thinking that if they turned back to go thank Jesus, they would suddenly no longer be healed because they didn't do what Jesus said? Like, there are absolutely plenty of stories in the Christian Bible, in all of scripture, in the scripture of plenty other religions that are just that picky and capricious. So I think that's a reasonable option. And this is one of those times I'm annoyed with Jesus, and I promise that doesn't actually happen too often, but now and then.
Also, I don't think any of them would necessarily, if they have been in a situation where they literally, like, can't do stuff. It's like, can they even afford what it would take to do all of the ritual things to prove themselves clean?
Yeah.
I don't know. And then in verse 18, Jesus asks, was none of them found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? And okay, it's my turn to be annoyed with Jesus.
Go right ahead.
Jesus has some ethnocentricity he needs to work through.
Right. But for real, like, this is some really fake, false othering, right? The Samaritan is not exactly a foreigner. They're like cousins. Literally, in the first reading, we have Elisha, the prophet, in Samaria.
Yes.
It's that the Samaritans didn't go off into exile and they came back. Yeah. And you can listen all about it in our podcast episode that we will link to about Samaritans. But like...
And their cookbook.
Yes, and their cookbook. But stop making Samaritans into like these foreigners. It's wrong. It also reminded me of Graceling, the book that I love, series that I love. Where the Gracelings, the people with graces, where their eyes change color, and so then they have, like, some superpower kind of thing, are othered. They are, like, estranged from society because either they are the property of the kings or they're too weird to be the king's property. And so people just, like, don't want graced children, and, like, they consider them outcasts and they consider them other when they're part of the community. Do better, people. Yeah. Do better. What I'm saying. Did you have any other thoughts on this, Katie?
No, I think you guys have covered it pretty well.
And now for our funnest segment, let's make a Muppets musical, where we cast a Muppets musical for one or multiple of the readings. So I have an idea that I came up with during Kay's conversation on the first reading, but I'm curious, Katie, if you have any that you'd like to start us off with?
Circle back to me, because I'm going to come up with something.
Okay.
I was less thinking about casting for this episode as I was for how would you portray leprosy with Muppets? Because, like, Muppets don't have fleshy skin like we do. Muppets are made out of cloth, and usually it's kind of like fuzzy cloth. And how would you portray leprosy with Muppets? And I'm thinking that I have seen a variety of portrayals of leprosy in various, like, low-rent TV shows. And usually the special effects are not great, and I don't imagine that any of those were anywhere near to realistic. But also, these are Muppets, so realistic is not what we're going for. And so I'm thinking it's something of a cross of, like, you're going for kind of using cotton batting as, like, a sort of tinsel-y thing, like cotton batting sort of stuck on the person and clearly falling off and then occasionally removing body parts for the leprosy effect. And then if you're dunking them in water to clean them, I have to imagine that a wet Muppet is about as sad as a wet cat.
Oh.
Yes.
Like, in terms of just, like, unfortunate to look at. And that actually gives Naaman a whole different level of being someone I can empathize with and, like, care about. And that seems oddly sweet in a way. And so
he comes out from his squats looking like a drowned cat.
Yeah. And you just kind of want to, like, give him a towel and pat him dry, and it would be sad. So I'm kind of struck with that now. But yeah.
That's fantastic. I was thinking when you were talking about before you said the cotton batting, I was thinking about leprosy, and I was like, oh, you could do, I was thinking, because they're normally fuzzy, that you could do either, like, a silk or a nylon type of thing, or those sequined pillows that, like, you swipe up and it's one, and you swipe down and it's the other, and so you just swipe them all, like, up or whatever,
or, like,
so
that velvet.
They're all, like, and then when you wash them, they go the other way and they're, like, blend in more like scabs. That was my thought on that one.
All right, so I came up with my Muppets casting.
Yes.
Excellent.
So after Alicia tells Naaman, you know, go and bathe in the Jordan, and Naaman has a hissy fit because the Jordan is this tiny little river that's beneath him, the servants who tell him, get a grip, I just picture that as, like, Miss Piggy just, like, hauling off and smacking him and being like, get your butt back there.
Yes.
Go take a bath.
That is fantastic. I feel like with that casting, I would want a human Naaman. But I was thinking, based on Kay's, like, how do you dunk yourself in the Jordan 7 times, being, like, doing squats? I was picturing a Big Bird Naaman, and I was, like, picturing Big Bird doing squats in the Jordan River. Just seemed,
and, like, if you're that tall, you'd really have to have a good center of balance and to be able to do squats and not get pulled away by the current.
So that is some fun casting for this episode.
And then coming back up and just looking like the saddest drowned rat you've ever heard of. Especially Big Bird, all those wet feathers would be so sad.
It's gonna take so long to preen.
Snuffleupagus is going to have to help, right? With the trunk.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, Katie, any other thoughts on life, the universe, and everything?
Would you guys like me to share with you one of my favorite extra-biblical headcanons?
Yes!
Ooh, yes!
Please?
So, I have a headcanon about John, the disciple, the beloved disciple.
Okay.
So, in artwork, medieval artwork and all that from the Renaissance, John is always depicted as a young, beardless man. And John and James were the sons of Zebedee, and their mom Salome was the sister of Mary. So Jesus and John were cousins, but we don't get any indication that they really knew each other growing up. And then when Jesus died on the cross, you know, if John is the beloved disciple who wrote the Gospel of John, then Jesus kind of gives, this is your son. I think that John was a trans man.
I was wondering if that's where you were going.
I think that Zebedee and Salome were affirming their son, and so they kind of moved away and were a little bit estranged from the rest of the family back in Nazareth. And John is in ministry with Jesus, and then Jesus is dying on the cross is to reconcile the trans son in the family and be like, okay, mom, get your shit together. This is your nephew. Forget any birth name. Forget any dead name. This is your son now.
Sure.
So that's my headcanon.
That's fantastic, and I love that.
Yes.
I might steal it.
Go for it.
It's so brilliant.
I mean, because it works.
Yeah.
Especially with him always being shown in artwork as a young beardless man, because, you know, it's not like he could take testosterone shots. He just had to kind of be the beardless dude.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Brilliant. Well, thank you, Katie. That was brilliant. The whole episode was. That particular headcanon I love so much. I'm still stuck on it. Thanks for being with us for this episode. I really appreciate it. And I'm glad that this worked out.
Yep. Yes. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 19th Sunday after Pentecost. This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter and Facebook at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's cheaper than getting a wet Muppet properly dry cleaned.
I was thinking it was cheaper than a meal in the hospital cafeteria, but that also works.
Also true, but I actually like Muppets, so.
I've had a couple good meals in the hospital cafeteria in my day.
Most of my good memories from hospital cafeterias involve pie, not like actual meals.
Pie is delightful. Yeah. It's true. Pie is delightful.
The pie was usually like eating my emotions, so not necessarily good memories, but still good pie.
Yeah. Also, let us know on Facebook or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christians said,
Pax vobiscum.